Hey, it's Canzano. I appreciate you making this podcast part of your day. Make sure you subscribe if you want more and leave us some feedback. Away we go.
Initialize sequence.
Welcome to The Baldcast, a production of John Canzano's Bald-Faced Truth.
Very excited about our next guest, one of my favorite people in sports media. And I feel like I should change the music for this segment. I change the music a little bit. Come here. Oh, the pageantry and the tradition of Augusta National. Well, it was just 2006 when our next guest, Jim Moore, graced Augusta National, the fairways, the greens, the tee boxes, with his presence. He carved up that course. Jim Moore joining us now. How'd I do?
Carved it up all right, John. Yeah, I didn't exactly carve it up. Unless you read a different column than the one I wrote, but the one I wrote showed that I shot a 99 there at Augusta National. And the thing is, though, that I didn't even really care that much, because it's just one of those things. It's on everybody's bucket list. And I was able to not only play it once, but play it twice. So I feel kind of guilty saying that. I mean, the time before when I played, I shot an 87, and I, you know, played from some of the member tees. And some of the guys I was playing with, you know, they were like, hey, we're not good enough to play back there. And I said, I know we're not good enough to play back there, but let's try it anyway.
Right.
Because let's see what the pros have to face when they're back there. And so I felt kind of weird because I was with other media guys, you know, and they probably thought, oh, God, Jim's a jerk. Look at him go and play in the member like he thinks he's really good. No, I just wanted to see what they were facing on Sunday there in the final round at Augusta.
And for people who don't know, the Augusta media contingent, every 7 years, you can enter the lottery. And on the Monday after the tournament, the media hacks are allowed to play the course. You say you played it twice. Give us an idea for people who may never get to Augusta, what that is like compared to like your local public course.
Well, number one, you're nervous as hell. You know, it was just like, hey, John, I typically, you know, drink while I'm playing, and then when I'm really nervous, like I played down here. I'm at Witchy Creek right now, just hitting some balls in Bend. And I played in the Pacific Amateur Tournament down here for 17 years in a row. And, God, I just got so nervous just even playing in a tournament like that that didn't really mean anything. And so typically, you know, just I didn't have the mental capabilities to stand on the tee sober while I was hitting. And so, you know, I had a couple beers before I got to the first tee there at Augusta just because I wanted to loosen up a little bit, and I couldn't loosen up on my own. I felt like I needed artificial help. So that was – honest to God, when I was standing, and the second time I played, we teed off on number 10, and then we played the front nine second. But the first time, it was, you know, starting at one and finishing at 18. And, yeah, I basically was just, and at the time, I was like an 11 handicap. And I don't know, you know, I was shooting in the 80s, that type of thing. But I was just literally hoping that I was going to hit the ball. I didn't want to whiff, because that would have been really embarrassing to whiff. And, yeah, it was nerve-wracking, for sure.
Give us an idea. Okay, from the start of the round, you check in at the pro shop. You know, from that point on, I'm assuming, do they give you a caddy? Is it a caddy who knows the course? How does that work?
Yeah, they give you a caddy. You get one of the, you know, one of the caddies there, and they're all standing there in their white outfits and the green hats. And I had a really good guy the first time and a really good guy the second time, too. And I just, they usually assign who you're going to get when you get there. But I saw the guys all lined up, and I know the guy that I picked, I saw that he had a ball retriever. And I thought, okay, I want that guy because I'm sure I'm going to be hitting some balls into Ray's Creek, and maybe he can fetch them out for me. And he was terrific. He was really good. And, yeah, it's first class there. The thing about Augusta where you think it's going to be all – dodgy and stuffy and all that type of thing, it really, those people in the green coats are honestly very nice. I went, you know, I was covering the tournament. I went there when I was with the PI, and I probably went there, I think, 4 years. And every time, they couldn't have been nicer. There was one time I went through security, And you ever do that when you lose your car keys and you can't figure out what the heck happened to them? And well, I left them in the little bowl that they gave you to go through the detector, and I didn't realize that. But anyway, the guy gave me a ride back to my hotel that night, and so yeah, it's first class all the way, but it's not quite as stuffy as you might think when you're watching it on TV.
Jim, I'm going to tell you a story. It's going to break your heart because you made it into that lottery twice and you played. I covered the 2004 Masters. It was the year that Mickelson won his first major with a birdie on that final hole. I beat Ernie Els, as I remember. And I was told by Art Spander, a longtime golf writer, he said, hey, you know, if you enter the lottery, you're going to play. Like, you're guaranteed because they're, you know, you're one of, like, this is the year. It just sort of happened that, you know, so many other guys, they were trying to figure out if they were going to play. So they were going around asking the golfers who had never played before, the writers who had never played, are you going to play in the media tournament? So Spander said to me, are you going to play? And I said, gosh, you know, I hadn't even thought about it. And he said, you know, if you enter the lottery, you are guaranteed to play because, you know, you'll get a spot. But he said, you know, if you haven't been playing, maybe you don't enter it and you come back next year. And you maybe play better. And I said, oh, you're right. You know, I haven't been playing. I'm going to shoot 120 out there. This isn't going to be pretty. So I did not enter the lottery. And the paper never sent me back.
No.
So no, I never got to play.
That's the fear that you have, though, because you watch these guys. I mean, the professionals, the best in the game. And you see them struggle. And you're going, well, what in the world am I going to do out there? Especially on the greens. And that was where it was most interesting. I mean, you can't really get an idea on TV the ups and downs of the course. Like, the first time I went there, John, I flew into Atlanta, and then I drove to Augusta. And what is it, like 2 hours, something like that?
Yeah.
I drove past my hotel because I wanted to get to Augusta. I just, you know, I'm one of those guys. I'm a sappy guy when it comes to golf. Like, when you play that music, some people want to just stick their finger down their throat. I just want you to turn it up. And I just want to, you know, get misty-eyed. I don't know. I don't know why I'm like that. But I drove by my hotel, and it was getting dark. And I thought, no, I got to go straight to the course. I got to go straight. I got to see 10. I got to see 11. I got to see 12. I got to see. We know all these holes. That's one of the things about Augusta and the Masters where you're just like, okay, what sets it apart? Well, we know all the holes. Like, if you say number 16 to me, I know it's a par 3 over water. You know, you say number 4. It's another par 3 that's long and difficult. But the greens, though, it's they're so difficult. I think I had 5 3 putts the second time I played. I mustn't have had too many 3 putts the first time when I shot an 87. But when I had a 99 and I think, what did I have, 4 8s, something like that? I almost had a hole in one at 16, though. I was so damn proud of myself, I couldn't believe it.
You know, even if you're shooting 99, I have to think it's one of the better golf days of your life because you are on a course that is pristine. And I try to tell people it's you think it's wonderful on television and then you see it in person and it's even better. It doesn't look real. It's like looking at the Grand Canyon. So what is that like to be on like the fairway of a par 5 and look up and, you know, you got a good lie and everything, there's no wind and the trees all look perfect and the grass is beautiful?
Well, it's you're right, though. I mean, just walking around as a media member and not playing, but being out there playing, you really get a feel for, there's not a single weed there. And I think if there is, they'll find it before the next day, before you get there. It's just so immaculate. It's just so perfect. And even with all the, and of course, you got to call them patrons and not golf fans when they're there. There's all these different rules that they have, but it's just such a fun event. And, you know, I mean, I played the thing for free too. There's people, I mean, how much would you pay to play at Augusta National? I mean, people would pay what? 5,000, 10,000, something like that.
Yeah.
More?
You get to play it. You get to play it and you get to go out there and you get to watch the golf. And after 3 or 4 days of being around it, You're into it, right? And then you're on the course, and you're right. You probably just want to keep the ball in play. You know, did you have, like, when you go to cover a golf event like that, people always ask me how I covered golf, because some of the golf writers would sit in the tent and watch it on TV. Others would go out and sit on a tee box. Others yet would find a golfer like Tiger Woods that they really liked, and they would just try to follow him in the gallery. How did you cover golf?
Well, for the most part, I got lucky with that because I was able to write columns at the time, and I didn't have to do the game story, so to speak, about, you know, whoever led after round one and who was chasing him and how they played and all that. If you're doing it like that, it's difficult because you're trying to go out there and get some nuggets that somebody else might not have. But while you're doing that, say you're on 13, you know, maybe somebody's tearing up the course and they're on 16 and you're not really privy to what's going on with that player. But probably the best day I had there was I wrote a column just sitting in the bleachers behind the 12th tee, and that's the iconic par three. And you could also look over, you could see the action on the 11th green, you could see the tee shots on 12, what was happening on the 12th green, and then you could also see the tee shots on 13, the dogleg left par five. So I just sat there. I'm just such a golf geek, John. I just sat there the whole day and just soaked it in. And I just was looking around. And I was like, thank you, God. Thank you so much. I hope I can write a good story because I've had such a good time. And what was interesting about it, the most interesting thing, is you look at that hole and you're going, eh, you know, 150 yards. These guys are professionals. But the wind really does weird things there. You can look off to your left over by the 11 green, and it's blowing one way, and you look over at 13, and it seems like it's blowing a different way. And so it, you see these guys all the time just kind of talking to their caddy and kind of looking to their left and looking to their right and looking up. And I had a heck of a day. I don't know if I did it justice in the column I wrote, but it was sure fun to be there.
The go-to guy, Jim Moore, with us, formerly of the Seattle PI and other media outlets. Jim, are you following this year, or did you follow today, and what were you into today, I guess, at Augusta?
Well, I watched a little bit of it today. I didn't. I was pretty busy doing some other stuff, but I think it's, I mean, the whole thing with the LIV golfers being there and, you know, DeChambeau being the leader now after the first round. And so I was paying attention on my phone, and I watched a little bit of it on TV. And of course, I bet on this stuff. I mean, I bet on 16 different guys, and John, I always bet them to win. I do, and I call, you know, people that bet, oh, why don't you bet top five? Why don't you bet top 10? Because I'm not a wuss, okay? I'm not going to do that. I don't go to horse races and bet on the damn horse to show. Yeah, I hate that, you know? Bet on the horse to win. Don't bet on it to show. And then they go, well, you know, if you bet on so-and-so, he finished third. If you bet top five, I'm like, I don't care. I don't care. I like it when they win. Like Brian Harman, one time I had like $10 on Brian Harman last year to win the British Open. It paid $1,000. That was more fun than, oh, thank you so much for the show money, you know. So, I don't know.
I love
I'm
it.
Crazy.
You go
anybody
for it.
Who bets on golf, anybody who bets on golf, John, will tell you it's crazy because it's impossible to pick a winner, except now that Scottie Scheffler's here, it's not as impossible as it used to be.
Yeah, yeah. Scheffler is in second. He is 6 under. One stroke back of the lead. Tiger Woods, did you put money on Tiger?
No, and if I had, I would have bet him to miss the cut. That's probably where I would have gone. But What is he? He's 1 under right now when play stopped, isn't he?
Yeah, 1 under. It looks like it was play was suspended at, with 5 holes to go for Tiger. But it's just, I find him really interesting and maybe more likable and relatable when he's at this point of his career, and he was so good when he's on top of the game. And do you think Tiger, you know, he talked about on a given day or a given tournament, if he could line back up, he thinks he could win one more. Do you believe Tiger can win again someday, or have we seen by far the best?
Well, I'm doubtful. Like I said, I just, you know, I would have bet that he'd miss the cut. I just think that a tournament like that, especially that's a difficult course to walk, and I just think as the tournament goes on, especially with what he has to do tomorrow, he's going to have to finish up his first round, sit around for a while. He'll probably get all stoved up and then, you know, then get out there again and try and get loose again. And, of course, how can you bet against Tiger Woods? Well, I did. You know, I mean, I just I think because of the injuries, not so much because of his age, and I forget what he is. Like, is he 46 now, 47, something like that?
Let me look him up here. I talked about it yesterday. He's 48.
Okay. Well, we've seen guys win major tournaments at 48 before, but not too often. And Tiger Woods would be the guy that would for sure be able to do that. But with his injuries, I'm not seeing it anymore. But, you know, he's already won six green jackets, so maybe he'll do it again. And, boy, that'd be a hell of a story, wouldn't it?
Well, I remember 1986. It was a 46-year-old Jack Nicklaus who kind of came out of nowhere. And, you know, he won that Masters. I watched it with my grandpa in his office. He had the TV on, and we watched every round of that tournament on television. And it was fun to kind of see that. And so, you know, you never know when someone is great, but you're right.
Do
I mean,
think
with a few.
John, do you think he can do it?
No, but I think what I was hopeful for is that he would shoot a really good round that made you wonder about it. You know, and he's only one under today, but like, had he been like four under, played out of his mind, and all of a sudden you kind of see his name in there, I just wonder what kind of impact he has on the other golfers. Do you think he has that at all? I don't think he has that anymore. I don't think they're looking at him.
Probably not. I mean, the kids out there that are 25, or like Batia, the kid who won last week in Texas, I mean, he's only 22. I'm sure they've heard stories about Tiger, but they're so young. I don't think they're intimidated by him anymore. You know, the other thing about Tiger Woods, though, people, you know, would say, what was it like seeing Tiger in person? And I used to tell them, I'd say, you know, you had a better view of Tiger Woods at home than you do yeah. at a golf course trying to watch him, because you're looking through so many heads that you can't really see him. It's just, it's 8 or 10 deep, at least when I was going to Augusta trying to watch him.
So you bet on 10 different golfers. Is it that you thought there are 10 guys that have a chance, or do you just see, you know, maybe there's 4 or 5 guys that you really like, and then the rest of them, hey, you like the odds on them?
It's all of the above. And actually, I bet on 16. But, you know, I'm just betting small amounts. I'm betting $4 and $5. I really liked Wyndham. I liked Wyndham Clark this week at 41.
Yeah. Okay.
I know a lot of people liked him. And then, you know, guys who have won for me in the past, I act like they're playing for me.
Right.
I put some money on Steven Jaeger because I had some money on him a couple weeks ago when he beat Scheffler. And I mean, Ryan Fox, he was on the leaderboard early today, the New Zealander. John, I watch golf all the time. I mean, I know all these guys from the European Tour and where they're playing. And I just get caught up in it because I look at the odds. I looked at Denny McCarthy. You know what McCarthy did last week with 8 out of 9 birdies, you know, in the last holes he was playing, and he forced a playoff. I mean, he just looked like he was red hot. 100 to 1, I'll take Denny McCarthy. I don't even know how he finished today, but good putter. And I get wrapped up in this, man.
He's two over today.
He's two over?
Yeah.
Well, okay, so I threw money away on him, didn't I?
Well, you never know. Maybe he shoots, breaks a course record tomorrow. Who knows? Hey, I didn't ask you this, but, you know, I don't know your take on the Ohtani translator gambling situation. I think your blend of media expertise, gambling knowledge, Japanese translator knowledge, Ippei Muzuhara. Do you buy that Shohei didn't know anything and he was just a victim in all this? Or what's your take when you hear this story?
Well, I think it's funny when you mention the word expertise connected to me, but I'm not so sure, John. I haven't been paying attention to sports as much since I lost my job 2 weeks ago. But to answer your question, yeah, it seems there's a lot of fishy elements to this story, aren't there?
He lost $16 million. Came out today. Thousands of bets.
Did it?
He was betting on, like, everything from soccer to football. They say he didn't bet on baseball. I'm not sure I believe that. And he lost $16 million he took from Shohei Ohtani.
Oh, man. Well, what do you think Shohei is involved?
I know of cases, as do you, where professional athletes or celebrities get taken advantage of by a wealth advisor or someone in their circle. I just have a hard time with, like, $16 million? Like, he didn't notice that? And, you know, but maybe the translator was in control of so much that, you know, Shohei, you know, obviously Major League Baseball, I think, is rooting like heck to find that he's innocent and he didn't know anything and he's just naive is what they're hoping for.
Well,
but
has it come out what this guy makes?
A couple hundred thousand.
Okay, because I was trying to find out what Ichiro's interpreter got here, and it was less than that, I think. And so I was trying to get an idea of, like, well, wait a minute, is this possible that this could happen? But I find it hard to believe that Shohei was involved in it, and I don't have anything, you know, backing that up exactly.
Right.
No great reason to say it, but I'm hoping he wasn't involved. Let's just put that.
I know. Apparently, Mizuhara, between December of 2021 and January of 2024, placed 19,000 bets.
What? 19,000 bets.
25 months, 19,000 bets, nearly 25 a day. He bet between $10 and $160,000 per bet. Average bet was $12,800. Net loss of $51,000 a day. And he lost $40 million in that period. He was down $40 million. Otani is missing $16 million. I don't know. Where the rest of the money? Steven, do we know where the rest of the money came from? Like, when they say he's down $40 million and only $16 came from Otani, what are we talking about?
I have no idea. That's why I feel like there's a lot of things we don't know about this case right now.
All right. Well,
yeah,
you guys.
No, it's, it's just. I remember one time I used to have a bookie, and, you know, I mean, we're not talking millions of dollars here. We're talking, you know, hundreds, and I got myself in trouble. I mean, it's just like any other addiction. You can get yourself in trouble with gambling, and, you know, you just start thinking things are going to turn, and then they don't turn, and he's probably chasing some of the money that you already lost, and, you know, just spiraled out of control on him.
Clearly. He bet on a University of Portland versus UCLA soccer match. How about that? That might have been his.
Did he win that one?
He lost that one. So he wasn't good. He wasn't good at it. All right. The go-to guy, Jim Moore. Hey, enjoy your golf in Bend. I love hearing your voice. We'll get you back on. I appreciate you, my friend.
Okay. Hey, thanks, John. Take care.
There he goes. The go-to guy, Jim Moore. He played Augusta National twice, 99 and 87. That's not bad. You think about that. Leave it here.
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald Face.
Hey, sorry to interrupt the podcast, but if you want to listen to more of the Bald Face Truth Radio Show, including more of this segment that you're listening to, make sure you subscribe on SoundCloud and iTunes to the Bald Face Truth Radio Show. Thanks for listening.